Well, cyber attacks like the one that crippled the city of Atlanta a few weeks ago are, in theory, entirely preventable. All it takes is knowing how hackers think and protecting the security issues that they might exploit, right? Well, at least you can punish them after they have exploited you, assuming your laws are correctly configured. SB 315 is on its way to Governor Nathan Deal's desk as we speak. It is a bill that would redefine unauthorized computer access as a crime under Georgia law, which would make data breaches easier to prosecute, or so that is the aim. But some in the tech industry worry that this measure could hinder their ability to do their jobs. With me to explain these concerns are two people who have worked with the Electronic Frontier Foundation of Georgia. One is Kate Bennett. She's a tech security specialist. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Also with us is Logan Hicks. He sits on the board of directors for the International Institute of Research and Development. Hello, Logan.
Hey, how's it going?
Could either of you just explain for us, in brief, what are Georgia's cybersecurity laws like right now, and how would this bill change them, assuming the governor signs it, which he's given no indication he won't do?
Well, currently the laws in Georgia are pretty loosely set in terms of cyber. Most states have relatively loose laws. They try to mock as most often as they can with the CFAA, which is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It's a federal law that criminalizes cybersecurity misbehaviors, as we like to state them in our industry. And for the overall majority, if you're caught committing a felony in our industry, you go to jail, and it's just a simple reality. But criminalizing at the state level, I think, has more impact on a negative side than it does on any real side, because if you've committed a federal act, you're going to get hit with the federal charges long before you're going to see any state ramifications. And again, from what I can see, to the best of my knowledge, at the state bill currently, they dropped it from a felony to a misdemeanor, which is equivalent of throwing a rock at your neighbor's mailbox.
Well, I suppose that, and I should emphasize, none of us here are lawyers, but we can at least spitball this about this a little bit. I suppose that if I were in Georgia and I hacked into a computer system in Georgia and no one from out of state was affected, perhaps I wouldn't be prosecutable under the federal law, that local prosecutors would need a law of their own to go after me. Is that conceivable?
It's not likely, and that's simply because unless you go to Georgia from where you're at currently, so if I were in Georgia and I broke into a Georgia systems, I would still have to transgress a large number of systems to get from system A to system B, and there's no guarantee that I won't cross federal lines by crossing from, say, for instance, a router from state of Georgia into the state of North Carolina, for instance, that will then pass me back into Georgia. So the conduit of my attempt at accessing your system would actually cross state lines, which would then make it federal jurisdiction if it were assessed in that manner, which they could, in which case it would become a federal crime.
All right. Well, Logan, we'll get back in a minute to why you think that it's problematic to try to criminalize these things at the state level as opposed to the federal level. But, Kate, could you just clear up for us, what does this new bill do? How does it change things in Georgia?
So currently, everyone's familiar with the Panera Bread incident, right? So
no.
Oh, really? Okay. So what happened was the user's data was publicly available. What I mean by publicly available is if you see a license, driver's license, on someone's driveway, you're walking by on a public street, and you look, and you can stand on the public street, which you're legally allowed to be on, which is equivalent to the World Wide Web, you can see the driver's license and read the data. Now, what you do with that data depends on whether you're a criminal or not, in my opinion, and under the current law. So if you take that data that you find, if you took the data from Panera Bread and sold it, or you took the driver's license information and sold it, then that's criminal activity, and it's sure prosecuted under current law. So the user's data that signed up, all the users that signed up for the Panera Bread's rewards card, was publicly available. People could access it. Now, the researcher told Panera Bread about it, and Panera Bread said, okay, we see your messages. And they said this for 8 months, and Panera Bread never fixed it. So then at that point, the security researcher exposed the fact that this had happened, and it made the news. Typically in security research, we do not, if we find a vulnerability, we notify the person that can fix it, because we, as the researcher who noticed it, do not have access to the code to fix it. The security researcher wasn't able to protect the user's data that Panera Bread was exposing. They needed Panera Bread to fix the issue, which they have. They took the website down the last I checked.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so we want these people that find these issues and report it in a proper way, such as to the company or to the police, just as you would if you found a driver's license, you would report it to, you know, you give it back to the person or give it to the police. And that's not a crime. Now, of course, if they took the data and sold it or used it for identity theft, then that is a crime. And so we want a bill that distinguishes the two and not just says, you know, anyone who finds this information can be prosecuted under SB 315.
So to keep going with your driver's license analogy, you're walking by the sidewalk and you see someone's driver's license laying in their driveway. You're saying that, at least within the computer world, this new bill headed to Governor Nathan Deal's desk in Georgia would criminalize not only the act of taking that person's identity off of their driver's license and using it to get a credit card and spend their money. It would also criminalize just looking at the driver's license?
Yes, looking at it and telling, I guess if you never told anyone you looked at it, it'd be hard to prosecute you. But if you did something like attempt to give the ID back to someone or even give it to the police, like, oh, you know, you bring the ID to the police department and they arrest you instead of saying thank you for not leaving this identity on the road for a truly bad person to get right. And start using the data. In general, I actually lost my license on the road on the street of Atlanta, and the person found it and gave it back to me, and I was super thankful.
Okay. So we're talking about a new bill that has been passed by the Georgia legislature headed to Governor Nathan Deal's desk, which would make unauthorized computer access a state crime in Georgia. And Logan, just to clarify this one more time, let me give you a real world example. So at some point, this is hardly the most serious example, but during the Trump campaign, people were talking about the Trump brand of steaks for a little while. And the Trump brand of steaks were no longer for sale on the Sharper Image or the Trump store, any place where Trump had previously sold steaks. But I kind of wanted to find out more about them just because I was bored one night. And I found that the pages where the items had been listed for sale were still on, I think it was the Sharper Images website. The links just weren't indexed anymore. You couldn't actually get to them through any search or through any publicly available link. But if you kind of figured out how their URLs were coded, you could just kind of find one. And I found these very unflattering, very terrible photos of terrible looking steaks. And I shared them on the internet because I thought that was funny. Would that theoretically be illegal under this bill, assuming the governor signs it?
Well, you're getting into gray area there, and it really could depend on interpretation based on intent. So the providers of the website did put the content out on a public-facing system, and the system is present on the platform, which is a public-facing medium. However, at the same time, they also took measures to make it unavailable, and at the same time, you took measures to make unavailable content available again. And so it would really depend on the person that you're talking to and based on their interpretation. I would most definitely say that if you went further than just a public-facing system and you actually started digging through their databases, you could definitely be looking at some serious problems there. It really would come down to interpretation by a DA or an assistant DA.
So it's pretty clear that both of you, as experts in cybersecurity, are generally opposed to this legislation. We have a little bit of time left here, not much. In a minute, could each of you explain why you think this is a bad idea? Logan, you go first.
Well, I think it's a bad idea overall because for a variety of reasons. One is a very clear showing that the state has a very moderate to modest, if any, actual understanding of our industry at all. For starters, with the fact that on the Atlanta site right now, they stipulate that with $4.7 billion, they held 25% of the global market share, which Gartner puts at $96 billion. Obviously, that math is off by a substantial sum. So there's a large issue right there just showing from just a generic market perspective that they don't understand what we're doing or how our industry works, which shows a wide variety of concerns, then showing that a lot of the people that came on committees prior to were completely sandbagged the second they showed up on multiple committee hearings, which really shows that they don't generally have an intent or interest in hearing what we have to say, which has led several of people in the industry, including myself, to start putting together exodus packages for corporations and personnel, where we're simply just going to transplant the entire industry to another state.
All right. Kate, in a minute, why do you think this is a bad idea?
So when they crafted the bill, no security experts were contacted or apparently even asked about, you know, what could make the bill successful. I think if we were going to build a software for a hospital, we would definitely contact a hospital and have their input as to what the software needs, you know, what kind of characteristics does the software need to have. I think if the legislation is going to craft a bill, and I'm not saying we don't need one, we probably do, and it would be really awesome if they would contact some people in the that have security expertise. We have a number of companies in the state of Georgia that would be happy to assist. And so that's what we would like to see. And then it would be better for the businesses in Georgia.
That's Kate Bennett. She's a security specialist, computer security specialist. We also heard there from Logan Hicks, who serves on the board of directors for the International Institute of Research and Development. Both of these folks were talking about Senate Bill 315, a bill that has been recently passed by the Georgia legislature criminalizing unauthorized computer access under state law in Georgia. It has yet to be signed by Governor Nathan Deal, but he's given no indication yet that he won't sign it. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Many of you no doubt welcome our next guest into your homes each weeknight on PBS.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The Trump administration announces new sanctions against Russia.
Last month, Georgia Broadcast Hall of Famer Judy Woodruff took the reins as permanent sole anchor of the PBS NewsHour. It is a big step from her early days as a journalist in Atlanta. Judy Woodruff recently spoke with my colleague Tony Harris.
With so much really, truly great journalism next to your name, where does being named sole anchor of the PBS NewsHour rank?
Well, it's got to be pretty close to the top. It's incredibly humbling, and I know people use that expression a lot, but I really mean it. I mean, to come to a place that was occupied originally by Robin McNeil and Jim Lehrer, and then by Gwen Ifill and me when we were named the co-anchors in 2013, and then, of course, we lost Gwen a little over a year ago, leaving a big hole in our hearts. But this is a very special place in American journalism. And so it's an honor. It's a huge responsibility. And at the same time, it's exciting because there's so much work to be done. There's so much journalism to be done. And I have an amazing team here supporting me.
I want to get to the journalism piece in a moment. I'm curious that the 2016 presidential campaign, right, and the Trump presidency so far has proven to be a real bonanza, right, for local news organizations, cable news organizations, and the ratings are through the roof across the board. What's the viewership story for the NewsHour during, you know, this same period?
Well, we're very grateful because our viewership has gone up significantly since before the election year of 2016, and it has stayed at a significantly higher level. And I do think it's because people are paying close attention. What we hear from our viewers on a regular basis is that they appreciate our straight approach to the news, the fact that we are reporting not only what's happening in this country or in 50 states and in Washington, but we also every night report on what's going on around the world. And they like the fact that we are, in effect, holding up a mirror to what's going on out there. And that we're covering the stories in Washington, which are plentiful, but that's not the only thing we do. We are continuing to cover education and science and the economy. But that's just one slice. There's so much to follow. And it's our mission to make sure we're paying attention to all of it.
How hard is it to avoid being pulled down the rabbit hole, my word, not yours, of covering what the president says or what the president tweets, and, you know, at the risk of losing sight of all the other journalism that you just described?
If all we wanted to do was to get up every morning and read the tweets from the president and the stories in different news organizations about what's going on in the Trump administration, we could fill the program with that almost every night. But that's not our mission. It's part of what we do, no question. We look at what the president is saying in his tweets and his speeches and his interviews and comments. And what other people report him to be saying in private meetings and elsewhere. But that's, you know, and we report on that, and we keep it in context because, frankly, some of the things that the president has said in a speech, either he chose not to follow through on, or for whatever reason, things ended up going in another direction. And so, you know, our mission really truly is to keep our eye on the entire landscape and to think, what do people need to know in order to get through the day and get through the week? Most people are out there working hard. They are raising their children or working on their career or doing whatever they're doing. And whatever goes on in Washington is not the end-all and be-all of their lives. So we have to keep that in mind, and we do keep that in mind.
You know, you've told aspiring journalists, this was a Facebook chat a while ago, that there's no such thing as being objective in covering the news, and that the best we can do is try to be consciously fair in approaching every story. Make sure we reflect all sides if there's controversy involved. So, Judy, what's the challenge of being objective today when even well-sourced stories are being called fake news?
Well, I really meant what I said when I said there's no such thing as being objective for a journalist. I think, you know, we're all human beings. We're the sum total of our experiences, you know, where we grew up, whether we're male or female, you know, where did we live, where have we traveled, you know, our family experiences, our professional experiences. None of us comes to what we do with a blank slate. Objective is something, a piece of paper is objective, but a human being isn't. And so the best we can do is try to be fair, to try to be open, to try to reflect all sides of the story. And that's what we try to do here at the NewsHour. And it's what we must do right now. I think more than ever, we are called on right now in this environment, in this hyper-politicized, hyper-partisan environment, to try to keep our feet on the ground and keep our head out of the clouds, to take a deep breath and think about what matters. Because as you said a moment ago, it would be so easy to get carried away every day with the noise, with the what other shiny objects are being thrown up in the air. And we can't do that. We owe our audience much more than that.
Judy, so here's the how and why question on how you keep getting up and jumping into the news fray question, right? Yeah, I remember you saying when you were leaving CNN, I do want to stay in journalism. I'm not leaving journalism. I'm just leaving daily journalism. You remember saying that? Do you remember?
I do remember saying that.
Okay, so here's the question. You are certainly back in daily journalism, and it is really a grind. I know it, and I know you know it. So how and why do you continue to do it?
Well, number one, I love it. I love it. When I said that in 2005 as I was leaving CNN, I truly thought I was leaving daily journalism. I was going off to work on a documentary. My plan was to teach. I wanted to write a book. I had all kinds of ideas in my head, but I didn't see what a daily journalism opportunity there was out there. And it just so happened that the NewsHour and I found our way back to each other. And I'm incredibly grateful for that every day. But the honest truth is that I love what I do. I mean, I really love the news. I love trying to figure out what's going on. I love asking questions. I think the most interesting thing in the world is a conversation with someone to try to get to the bottom of whatever it is, whether they were involved in a news story or whether they wrote a book or they're a political leader or they're an education leader or they discovered something or they're an astronaut. You know, there are just so many things to be discovered. The world is so full of this and that and the other, and it's going to take the rest of my life to figure it all out, right? I mean, seriously, I think it, to me, it's just, how could anybody be bored doing what we're doing. It's just, it's a privilege every day to come into the NewsHour and think about the things that matter and to have a chance to try to understand them and to make them understandable to the people who are reading or following us on television.
So, Judy, it's always a bit weird to read what's written about you, right? So what was your reaction to the New York Times description of your performance style? And here it is, quote, Ms. Woodruff's measured delivery with her hands clasped and her voice low stands as a counterweight to a haywire era of American news. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I thought it was interesting. I hadn't really thought of myself that way because the truth is that my hand, I have what they call in the television world nervous hands because I tend to be in constant motion, and my hands are fidgeting on the desk. So the fact that, that the article said that they were clasped very properly, I thought was a nice commentary. I thought, oh my goodness, I must have held them still for one night. But no, seriously, you never know what somebody's going to write. I was grateful that the New York Times actually profile the program and said so many wonderful things about the work that we're doing.
When I think about my years in the business, I think about the places and the people along the way, right? So I'm wondering how important was Atlanta and by extension the state of Georgia as a place in your career?
That's a great question, and it's interesting. I don't get asked that very often, but I did spend a year and a half as a secretary in the newsroom at then WQXI television right out of college, and then I worked for 5 years for WAGA when it was a CBS affiliate. Right after that, covering the state legislature, covering city politics, did stories on redlining and blockbusting and really interesting work. That's where I cut my teeth as a reporter. That's where I fell in love with covering politics. I didn't know until I was just about to graduate from college that I even wanted to go into journalism, so Atlanta was everything to me. I mean, it was a wonderful place to be a reporter. There was so much going on at that time. It was the early 70s, and we were dealing with a lot. I mean, the South had come through segregation, but was still struggling at that time. I covered the Jimmy Carter race for governor in 1970. Of course, the little-known former peanut farmer went on to do other things. So it was, it made all the difference. And I had a producer who would say to me on a regular basis, you're only as good as your last story, who reminded me that no matter how great you feel about some work you've done, there's more work to be done the next day and the next day and the next day. And I learned a lot. The man who hired me to be a reporter at WAGA named Bob Brennan, who's still around and living in Atlanta, I consider a great mentor. He gave me a chance when nobody else would. And I'm incredibly grateful to him.
Judy, here's the question that would be probably most helpful to aspiring journalists and young working journalists like those crafting this program. What is your daily news routine, and has it changed much over the years?
It's changed tremendously, thanks to social media and the web and the rest of it. I used to get up in the morning and read the newspapers. I still read the newspapers, and sometimes I read them whole, holding them in my hands. In fact, I try to do that as often as I can. But of course, I'm also constantly checking my smartphone for everything from news feeds to Twitter to every place you can imagine, that news is coming in. And then when I get to work, it's the same thing. You're on the computer, you're looking at the wire services, which have been around for a while, but you're checking so many other sources of news, and on a daily basis, any news organization can be breaking something. You've got to pay attention in all directions. I have to say, it's exciting because this, we've been through this period when so many news organizations have had to either disappear, go out of business, or shrink. And having said that, there's still some great journalism going on. I mean, the great competition these days between the Washington Post and the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and other news organizations, the Associated Press, and I could go on and on and on. It's really exciting. But yes, it's absolutely changed.
To the question of what you need to be a journalist, you responded that you need an insatiable curiosity, the refusal to say no when someone tells you they won't be able to help you, and a love of news and current events. You can specialize, but at a basic level, and I love this part, you need to care about the world around you and the people in it. Does that statement feel as true to you today as it ever has? It feels that way to me.
Yes, you should not go into journalism if you don't care about, you know, what's going on to the people around you, whether they're in this country or around the world. And I see that. I'm just heartened every day when I talk to young people who are trying to decide whether or not to go into journalism. What they say is, well, should I do this? I see this newspaper closing down or that news organization, downsizing. And I say, look, there's always going to be a need for information. The American people, the people around the world, are always going to need news in order to function. In this country, it's essential to our democracy. We don't have a democracy unless we have freedom of the press. And frankly, that's another reason that in this environment where people are calling out fake news, and that's coming from the highest, you know, political levels of highest levels of our government. That I think is something we have to stand up to every day and show that, you know, we're here to do serious work and to do it honorably and to make sure it's accurate, and to be humble about the work we do. The one thing I would add to what you said is, I think journalists have to be humble. We can't ever assume that we know everything. I think there have been some moments in our history when I think journalists have gotten to a place where they kind of think they've figured it out. And I think we have to be humble. We have to remember that we are not the font of all wisdom, and we have to keep asking. That's why we're here, to keep asking, to keep learning, and to keep sharing with the people we're writing for or reporting for. And I think the need has never been greater than it is today. It's always been great. It's always been essential to have great journalism. But today we need it more than ever. Look at the challenges this country's facing. Look at the challenges people living around the world who are in much worse condition than what we are living in here in this country. But yes, there are pockets of this country where people are suffering, no question, in urban and rural America. And we need to worry about that and pay attention to that, as well as people who seem on the outside to be doing all right, but they're not. I mean, there's so much to report on. The work never ends.
Judy, congratulations on being named the permanent sole anchor of the PBS NewsHour.
That's Judy Woodruff of the PBS NewsHour speaking with my colleague Tony Harris. Judy was recently named the sole anchor of the PBS NewsHour. Well, a few weeks ago, we talked about the shift in attendance among African Americans in evangelical churches. The Pew Research Center finds that only about 10% of African Americans in Georgia identified as evangelical Protestant in 2014. Nationwide, it's even lower, and all these numbers are going down. Fewer and fewer African Americans are attending evangelical churches. We talked about what's behind this trend with my colleague on the Mercer University faculty, Shaniqua Walker-Barnes. She says that she left her evangelical church because topics about race were rarely brought up.
There is a vast difference in terms of the approach to issues of race and really talking about race in terms of the background and the heritage of evangelicalism and when that initial split happened.
Now, Walker Barnes says that the split should be a matter of concern to all involved. Robert P. Jones agrees. He is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute.
Killings of African-American men by police. 75% of African-Americans say that's part of a broader pattern of how police treat African-Americans. Only 29% of white evangelical Protestants agree with that statement.
So that's what we talked about a few weeks ago. Now, to move that conversation forward, we welcome two evangelical pastors who are trying to change this narrative at their particular church. Tim Rogers and Catherine Gillard are co-pastors of New Life Covenant Church in Atlanta. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, just to be clear, you both identify as evangelical, and your congregation you would characterize as evangelical?
I would characterize it in the historical use of the word, not in the current use that's often used with the political connotations that come with it.
Okay, we'll unpack that in just a minute. It's a racially mixed congregation?
Yes.
50-50. So what, generally, what's the proportion?
50-50.
Okay. And you both as humans, as co-pastors, are a mixed group as well, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Tim is white. Catherine is African-American. Now, you heard the segment that we did on the show a few weeks back where we had three experts describing the evangelical theological tradition as being inextricable from racism, saying that it was historically, from a historical perspective, founded as an instrument of white supremacy and that it now supports political causes that perpetuate white supremacy. How would both of you respond to that?
Yeah, like I mentioned, I would hold to the theological convictions of evangelicalism that go back even before the founding of our country. So some of those theological convictions around scripture and salvation through Christ and others. But as it developed in our country and took on this, developed along lines of racism and political convictions that tend to be on the far right, I wouldn't hold those, and I don't think our congregation would hold those perspectives either.
Catherine?
Yeah, I think it's important that we remember the history, as was talked about on your prior show, of what led us to the point where we're existing today, but how we marry what we say we are and what we do in ways in which we are a stronger witness for Christ and not moved so much by the political sway or the cultural biases that are present everywhere. We tend to want to be people that's incarnational in our ministry, and which simply means that we talk about those issues that affect the people that are meeting there in our community of faith. It shouldn't be that we can't talk about anything in church and not only talk about it, but embody it in the way we live and the way we care for one another and the way we advocate for those who are being pushed to the margins.
So we've been talking about this because there's some new data indicating that African Americans are fleeing evangelical congregations in Georgia and nationally. What are some specific steps that y'all have taken as co-pastors to prevent that from happening at your church, which, as we mentioned, is an evangelical church in Atlanta that maintains a roughly 50-50 racial makeup, black and white?
Part of our call is to model what we believe, and so Pastor Tim and I both believe it's essential for us to be present as a white man. He resembles and represents all of the power-holding structures in the United States. As an African-American female, I am probably the most marginalized voice in the United States, and so together we share power, and that's a powerful witness for our congregation and those who come to witness what Christ can do in the midst of power sharing. But we don't always only talk about the dynamics of power and race and how we got there. We model it and we try to be formed and shaped by our history. Nothing in our history tells us that this is possible. If we look back on how we got to this place, we would leave the church as well. But we believe that we are called to do and model something differently.
And as we share,
go ahead, Tim.
As we share that power, that provokes a conversation. And so, gender, race, they're continual topics that come up in everyday life, in our Bible studies, in our sermons. It's not forced. It's just part of who we are. And so, it's a constant conversation for us.
Yeah, so it sounds like when a topic like Black Lives Matter is in the zeitgeist, it's something you don't shy away from in talking with your congregation. Tim, have you and Catherine made any adjustments to, forgive me for not knowing the terminology, but liturgical practices, just ways of doing things at the church to make the church structurally more inclusive?
Yeah, it's very important for us to think about how we worship together and what we model. So we have been intentional about having conversations as a faith community on a regular basis. This is not a topic that you can just have a workshop on and believe that you've settled anything. So we talk about it quarterly at what we call Ephesians 2:15 discussions, where we invite the whole community and our community of faith in to talk about issues of justice. We also have a year-long cohort for those who are experiencing that quarterly conversation that want to go deeper. And we come together once a month and we spend about 2.5 hours together talking about how we got to this place of segregation in the worship space. And then we also host an annual conference that will be coming up May 5th and 6th this year, where we invite people from all walks of life that are doing ministry in communities like ours, under-resourced communities, to come together and talk about how we model a different witness. And so the worship practices that we have had to change include how we begin to talk about the rallies that are going on in worship. How do we make space to lament with people who are in pain? How do we begin to help our congregation understand the importance of being registered to vote? How do we begin to talk about those issues that face you in your workplace, in the community, as our community is being gentrified? So we model that. We make space for it in worship. We talk about what the Word of God teaches us about being a stronger witness for caring for those who are being left out and pushed out.
Tim, in our last minute that we have to discuss this, if there's one tip that you could give to other pastors of historically white or predominantly white churches to make their places of worship more inclusive, what would it be?
I think you've got to decide if you really want it, truly, not just the assimilation that has generally been the route of what we would call a multicultural church, but if you really want the to go deep, it takes intentionality, and it's a long road, and so it can't just be a token investment. It has to involve long conversations, a reshaping of your worship, a willingness to enter into lament and to relearn your history, all these components that we have worked really hard at, but it's not a quick fix, and it has to go deep.
That's Tim Rogers and also Reverend Catherine Gillard. They are senior pastors of New Life Covenant Church, a racially mixed evangelical church in Atlanta. Thank you so much for this conversation. Now let's add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are simple. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists cannot pick one of their own songs. We talked with Meredith Franco and Julia Kugel of the Atlanta-based punk rock group The Coat Hangers, and here are their picks for our Essential Georgia playlist.
My name's Meredith Franco. I play in The Coat Hangers. We're from Atlanta, Georgia.
I play bass.
Hey, my name is Julia Kugel, also sometimes Crooked Coat Hanger, and I play guitar in the Coat Hangers from Atlanta, Georgia. The first song we want to talk about for the Georgia playlist is the Subsonics, their song Frankenstein.
They call me Frankenstein, I was designed. Out of line, an electric vine. It is so strong that they can't be denied.
I think it's one of the first songs that we actually heard by them, and it's just so cool. It's just really a cool
we
song.
Learned how to play it.
Yeah, we did learn how to play it. We were almost going to cover it. Actually, we should.
We
do
should.
That.
Yeah.
What are we doing? We got to write these things down.
They call me Frankenstein. I was not baptized. I broke all the Ten Commandments and it felt just fine. Yeah, you thought that you could stop me, but you shouldn't have tried.
It just has kind of like an FU attitude to it. It's like a really great sound. I don't remember what exactly I was doing. Might have been smoking weed. It's a good bet.
It's like a creepy, like
super creepy and like kind of, yeah, his voice is really unique. And it kind of like starts off like very like, what's that word? It kind of puts you in a trance, you know, like da 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 da. And you're like, what, where are we going? We're going somewhere weird. I guess I don't even know if it has a chorus, really. It just has, like, a really cool guitar freak-out part. Mm-hmm. And every time we see him play it, it's completely different. And that's one of the best things is when an artist just is an artist and doesn't put on a show but has their own show and you're watching this thing that's happening. It's really exciting. But you couldn't pry your eyes on what you're learning to spy from Frankenstein. From Frankenstein. Yeah, what you seen in me. It's really real and really raw and comes from somewhere. You know, it's like Billie Holiday, like, never sang a song twice the same way. It's kind of like that. It's like, oh, whoa. It's like, ah, rad. I wonder what he's going to do now. And it just goes just crazy. It's like, wow, wow, wow.
When I hear it, I'm just like, ah. Oh. And I always want to do this for some reason.
Just Thriller dancing. Dance.
The second song we picked is The Black Lips, Bad Kids. The Black Lips are based in Atlanta.
Bad kids, all my friends are bad kids, product of no dad kids, kids like you and me.
We are a minority, respect for authority, play well with others, from all your mothers.
Kind of harkens back to our youth when we would just throw things, you know, and like...
Just go crazy.
Yeah, just, you know, throw empty beer cans, and everyone would just go off in a friendly way, but that's kind of what we took from the Atlanta music scene in the beginning, was just being wild. Just the ability to be wild and no one really was policing you.
It's kind of like an anthem.
Kind of like empowering song for all the people that grew up with nothing, getting picked on, and then being like, whatever, we're bad kids. You're like, hey, we're from the South. Really good, good people, but if you cross us, you're gonna probably get stabbed. And that's kind of the South. The South has a swagger to it, and it's more about the feel rather than the...
You can feel that, like, what everyone has been through and, like,
yeah,
honest.
That was Meredith Franco and Julia Kugel of the Atlanta-based punk rock group The Coat Hangers. You can find the entire Georgia playlist series along with all of the great music segments that we've done at gpbnews.org.